after the dust settles, what a new Libyan government would look like.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, in for Steve Chiatakis. Now the global perspective on business and economics. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi appeared on television in Libya, encouraging his followers to fight, but the rebels seem to have the upper hand, and they'll soon need to create a new government. Joe Ford joins us now. He's a senior analyst with Oxford Analytica. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
So, Joe, it seems as if a rebel victory is fairly close at hand. What are some of the first steps a new government would have to take?
I think the first point to remember is the limited utility of making comparisons from other places, whether they be Iraq, Afghanistan, or other countries that have been through transition. But it is possible to draw some broader lessons from these sorts of things. They generally relate to issues around security sector reform and integrating opposing forces into a national police and army, transitional justice issues and how one deals with those, the economy and providing some sort of momentum in bread and butter terms to people.
As you mentioned, we've seen a lot of countries go through the Arab Spring, obviously all very different countries, but are there any models among those that might work for Libya or parts of those situations that are parallel to Libya's situation?
Well, there's been a lot of talk comparing the Libya situation with Iraq. One of the things that's very different about the Libya and Iraq situation is that the Transitional Provisional Authority in Iraq was a U.S. administration, whereas the Transitional National Council is composed of Libyans themselves. So legitimacy and effectiveness are interlinked issues when it comes to these sorts of transitions.
Well, one of the tasks of a new government obviously would be building up a strong functioning economy. That requires things like, you know, a strong banking system, tax collection, things like that. How ready is a country like Libya to sustain those elements?
Libya's transition is taking place at a time when Europe, which is just across the Mediterranean, is not necessarily in a very good place to help out. So the level of despair that might usually accompany a sort of post-conflict transition is more really about the macro global environment than Libya's own potential, which is still relatively good.
Joe Ford is a senior analyst at Oxford Analytica. Joe, thank you.
Thank you very much, Stacey.
Aid agencies have expressed concerns about safety and living conditions in Tripoli. Foreign workers especially have been a target of violence throughout the conflict. Now those same foreigners may be relied on to help rebuild the country. But first, they'll have to come back. Reporter Christopher Worth has more.
Libya has had to rely on immigrants to help build and run its billion-dollar oil sector. And those migrant workers from Asia, the Middle East, and other parts of Africa made headlines fleeing en masse across the Tunisian border or by boat to Europe since the conflict erupted. The International Organization for Migration says out of 2.5 million foreign workers that were in Libya, around 660,000 have left in the past 6 months. Thousands have remained in Tripoli, either to protect business interests or in the hopes of collecting unpaid wages, a big problem for migrants caught up in the fighting. Sabella Wilkes is with the UN's refugee organization. She says now that the Gaddafi regime has collapsed, they're not likely to want to evacuate.
Those that have stayed have really stayed through the bitterest, most difficult period. And of course, they probably have the most to lose by leaving, because I think they see that there's potentially a lot of opportunity when the conflict's over.
She says migrant workers will play a big part in rebuilding Libya. Another question is whether those remaining in camps in Tunisia will return to take up their old jobs once it's safe to do so. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
It is a mixed morning for the markets. Asian markets fell this morning as Moody's downgraded Japan's credit rating, citing political turnover. The country may have a new prime minister next week. The Nikkei index fell more than 1%. Europe is looking up, though. London's FTSE is up 0.1%. And U.S. markets had a really good Tuesday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 3% to close at 11,176.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. and by Allianz, providing retirement solutions that can help to guarantee income for life through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at JaguarUSA.com.
North Korea's reclusive leader Kim Jong-il is on a rare foreign trip to Russia. South Korea says it shows the North's willingness to consider new economic cooperation. First and foremost, building a gas pipeline connecting South Korea to Russia. Peter Van Dyke reports from Moscow.
Kim Jong-il is afraid of flying, so he rode his personal armored train across Siberia to meet with President Dmitry Medvedev. Stops to inspect a hydroelectric dam and a new pipeline pumping Russian oil to China are clues as to what the two leaders talked about. North Korea is in dire economic straits, and Moscow wants to expand its economic presence in Asia near China. At the same time, Russia and other countries want North Korea to drop its nuclear weapons program. Fyodor Lukyanov is the editor of the journal Russia in Global Affairs. He says wielding an international stick hasn't worked, so shifting to an economic carrot may be a better solution.
Russia is trying to look at North Korea not as a crazy rock state, but as a normal partner for a regional economic project.
Lukyanov says it is impossible to predict how Kim Jong-il will react. He took 4 days to get to the meeting with Medvedev. Any movement on the Korean peninsula is likely to be just as slow. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
And finally, Mongolia's Olympic athletes have themselves a sponsor, mining giant Rio Tinto. It's sending the country's tiny team, about 30 athletes, to the London Games. You could call it enlightened self-interest. Mineral-rich Mongolia is a huge battleground for mining companies. And Rio Tinto actually has more money than Mongolia. The Asian nation's GDP is around $7 billion. Rio Tinto is worth more than $80 billion. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. And this is the Marketplace Morning Report. This is APM, American Public Media.
Oil extraction's a tough gig, so oil companies are shelling out big money for qualified people. Petroleum engineering degree, anyone?
Coming out as a female PhD from America, I can probably get at least six figures when I start, which seems ridiculous because I've had no actual work experience.
I'm Bob Moon, new oil technology at a high price. Next time on Marketplace from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.